Chapter 16. With its own stock exchange and bordel, Johannesburg became a city. Even Kruger recognized it. He deposed the Diggers Committee and sent in his own police force, sold monopolies for essential mining supplies to members of his family and government, and set about revising his tax laws with special attention to mining profits. Despite Kruger's efforts to behead the gold-laying goose, the city grew, overflowed the original government plots, and spread, brawling and blustering, out into the surrounding veldt. Shaun and Duff grew with it. Their way of life changed swiftly. Their visits to the mines fell to a weekly inspection, and they left it to their hired men. A steady river of gold poured down from the ridge to their offices on Eloff Street, for the men they hired were the best that money could find. Their horizons closed in to encompass only the two panelled offices, the Victoria Rooms and the Exchange. Yet within that world Shaun found a thrill that he had never dreamed existed. He had been oblivious to it during the first feverish months. He had been so absorbed in laying the foundations that he could spare no energy for enjoying or even noticing. Then, one day, he felt the first voluptuous tickle of it. He had sent to the bank for a land title document he needed, expecting it to be delivered by a junior clerk. But instead, the sub-manager and a senior clerk filed respectfully into his office. It was an exquisite physical shock, and it gave him a new awareness. He noticed the way men looked at him as he passed them on the street. He realized suddenly that over 1,500 human beings depended on him for their livelihood. There was satisfaction in the way a path cleared for him and Duff as they crossed the floor of the Exchange each morning to take their places in the reserved leather armchairs of the members' lounge. When Duff and he leaned together and talked quietly before the trading began, even the other big fish watched them. Hradsky, with his fierce eyes hooded by heavy lids, Jock and Trevor Hines, Carl Lochkamper, all of them would have given a day's production from their minds to overhear those conversations. "Buy," said Shaun. "Buy, buy, buy," clamoured the pack, and the prices jumped as they hit them, then slumped back as they sucked their money away and put it to work elsewhere. Then, one March morning in 1886, the thrill became so acute it was almost an orgasm. Max left the chair at Norman Hradsky's side and crossed the lounge towards them. He stopped in front of them, lifted his sad eyes off the patterned carpet, and almost apologetically proffered a loose sheaf of papers.
"Good morning, Mr. Courtney. Good morning, Mr. Charleywood. Mr. Hradsky has asked me to bring this new share issue to your attention. Perhaps you would be interested in these reports, which are, of course, confidential, but he feels they are worthy of your support."
You have power when you can force a man who hates you to ask you for favours. After the first advance by Hradsky, they worked together often. Hradsky never acknowledged their existence by word or look. Each morning Duff called a cheerful greeting across the full width of the lounge. "Hello, Chatterbox!" or "Sing for us, Norman!" Hradsky's eyes would flicker, and he would sag a little lower into his chair. But before the bell started the day's trading, Max would stand up and come across to them, leaving his master staring into the empty fireplace. A few soft sentences exchanged, and Max would walk back to Hradsky's side. Their combined fortunes were irresistible. In one wild morning's trading alone, they added another 50,000 to their store of pounds. An untaught boy handles his first rifle like a toy. Sean was 22. The power he held was a more deadly weapon than any rifle, and more sweeter, more satisfying to use. It was a game at first, with the Witwaters Rand as a chessboard, men and gold for pieces. A word or a signature on a slip of paper would set the gold jingling and the men scampering. The consequences were remote, and all that mattered was the score. The score chalked up in black figures on a bank statement. Then, in that same march, he was made to realize that a man wiped off the board could not be laid back in the box with as much compassion as a carved wooden knight. Karl Lochtkamper, the German with a big laugh and a happy face, laid himself open. He needed money to develop a new property on the east end of the Rand. He borrowed and signed short-term notes on his loans, certain that he could extend them if necessary. He borrowed secretly from men he thought he could trust. He was vulnerable, and the sharks smelt him out. "Where is Lochkamper getting his money?" asked Max. "Do you know?" asked Sean. "No, but I can guess." Then the next day Max came back to them again. "He has 8 notes out. Here's the list," he whispered sadly. "Mr. Haradsky will buy the ones that have a cross against them. Can you handle the rest?" "Yes," said Sean. They closed on Carl on the last day of the quarter. They called the loans and gave him 24 hours to meet them. Carl went to each of the 3 banks in turn. "I'm sorry, Mr. Lochkamper, but we have loaned over our budget for this quarter. Mr. Haradsky is holding your notes, I'm sorry." "Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Lochkamper. Mr. Charleywood is one of our directors." Carl Lochkamper rode back to the exchange. He walked across the floor and into the lounge the last time. He stood in the center of the big room, his face gray, his voice bitter and broken. "Let Jesus have this much mercy on you when your time comes. Friends, my friends. Sean, how many times have we drunk together? And you, Duff, was it yesterday you shook my hand?" Then he went back across the floor, out through the doors. His suite in the Great North Hotel wasn't 50 yards from the exchange. In the members' lounge, they heard the pistol shot quite clearly. That night, Duff and Sean got drunk together in the Victoria Rooms. Why did he have to do it? Why did he have to kill himself? "He didn't," answered Duff. "He was a quitter. If I'd known he was going to do that, my God, if only I'd known. Damn it, man, he took a chance and lost. It's not our fault. He'd have done the same to us. I don't like this. It's dirty. Let's get out, Duff. Someone gets knocked down in the rush, and you want to cry, 'Enough!' It's different now, somehow. It wasn't like this at the start." "Yes, and it'll be different in the morning. Come on, laddie. I know what you need. Where are we going?" "To the opera house." "What will Candy say?" "Candy doesn't have to know." Duff was right. It was different in the morning. There was the usual hurly-burly of work at the office, and some tense action at the exchange. He thought about Carl only once during the day, and somehow it didn't seem to matter so much. They sent him a nice wreath. He had faced the reality of the game he was playing. He had considered the alternative, which was to get out with the fortune he had already made. But to do that would mean giving up the power he held. The addiction was already seated too deeply. He could not deny it. So his subconscious opened, sucked in his conscience, and swallowed it deep down into its gut. He could feel it struggling there sometimes, but the longer it stayed swallowed, the more feeble those struggles became. Duff comforted him. Duff's words were like a gastric juice that helped to digest that lump in the gut, and he had not yet learnt that what Duff said and what Duff did were not necessarily what Duff believed. Play the game without mercy. Play to win.